You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and we are here with a special guest, Dave K of Mustard Plug. And the reason Dave K of Mustard Plug is on the show is because I have heard the brand new Mustard Plug out. Well, it's not brand new, it's been out a little while now. It's called Why Does It Have to Be So Hard? And I heard it, and it's great, and I love it a lot, and I think it's awesome. Dave, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having
And we're here with Dave M. How are you, M? We talked about Dave M is in
See
Canada,
you.
so we talked about
Yes.
Thanksgiving last week. So, M, how was your week while I was enjoying Thanksgiving and a couple of days off? Did you do anything interesting, or do you just do Canadian things?
I fought a Canadian goose. I wrangled a
Really?
moose, and I drank about a liter of Tim Hortons.
Well, fair enough. M is doing those Canadian things. Dave, but we're not talking about M. We're talking about
Yeah.
Dave. Dave, the new record, it's out on Bad Time Records right now. Why Does It Have to Be So Hard? And I'm sorry, Where Did All My Friends Go, rather? I
Yeah.
gave the wrong title.
That'd be a good name for the title. I should have been the title, maybe.
So I guess the first question is, Dave, and I'm not, I'm going to throw a couple kind of generic questions at you, but I think we'll have some interesting responses for these. Is why 10 years between the last album and the new album? What took so long?
It's just, I think that point of our lives where we're just like busy doing other stuff, have like full-time jobs, have kids. So that's a big part of it. That's probably the main thing. I think also, like, as you get older, it's hard to find inspiration. I think when you're younger, all this new stuff is being thrown at you. And so you're there's just a lot more inspiration in general. I mean, I think most of us are in like pretty stable relationships too, which makes for like boring songwriting. It's like so that and the other thing too is like we've been in a band for like 30 years, and so people aren't as desperate to hear new Mustard Plug stuff as they were when we first started. I mean, it's kind of almost a challenge to get people to like be open-minded to hear new stuff from a band that's been around like this long time. And I get it. I mean, I think like even like the Rolling Stones, they just put out a new record too, and it's like, people just want to hear Satisfaction, that sort of thing. So there's like less pressure for us to do stuff, but everything just kind of came around, and mainly sitting at home during the whole pandemic thing, that was kind of a novel experience, and it was just the kind of the energy and the inspiration we needed. Just like kind of you get more a little introspective and have more time on your hands, so. Combination of all that led to the write a bunch of new songs.
Dave, you mentioned something interesting off the bat. As you said, people only want to hear Satisfaction with the Stones. I think I told the story even last week because the Stones are going on tour and I got tickets and everything. But when I saw the Stones in 2005, they did a bunch of Rare stuff and I was blown away. They did like She's So Cold, they did Shine a Light, they did maybe Heartbreaker from Goat Tattoo. But I was like, wow. And on my way out, people were like, I didn't know half the songs. I was bored. You know what I mean? So for you, is it frustrating that the fans, and this is true for almost every single artist, except for, like, as I said last week, Stevie Wonder, he can play whatever he wants, people love it. But pretty much anybody except for Stevie Wonder, from Paul McCartney to the Rolling Stones to even like Joe Strummer when he was alive, people really just wanted to hear Clash stuff. Is it frustrating you that people just want to hear the hits, or is that rewarding that people at least want to hear certain songs so much,
Well, I mean, on one hand, I'm like grateful that anyone wants to hear anything at all from us. You know what I mean? But so that's part of it. But it is frustrating because I mean, we put a lot of time and effort into this record. We left our homes, our families, our jobs for like whatever 3 weeks to go record it in Colorado, that sort of thing. Just invested a lot into it, and you go on like Spotify and like we have like whatever I don't know how many a bazillion fans, and then you realize that they listen to us, but then you realize there's so many of them that still have not heard our new record and just haven't bothered. I'm like, ah, just come on, listen to the new record, give it a shot, but so that's definitely frustrating. But on the other hand, there's a good chunk that have, and more have heard it, and the people that have heard it are really digging it. And we've been touring a lot since it came out in September, so it's been like what, 2, 3 months. And every time we play, there's more people that know the words. So, I mean, we just kind of go back into like Mustard Plug mode, which is just like hitting the road and pounding the pavement and just spreading the word that way. And it takes time. It's more work than I want to be, but you know, it's we're kind of like have to work to sell the songs to new people, but it's paying off little by little, you know.
Well, I'm going to say something I probably shouldn't say, but I'm going to say anyways, a testament to the new record in that I was aware of Mustard Plug and I've heard Mustard Plug, but I wasn't necessarily a Mustard Plug fan per se. And then I heard the new record and I became a fan. I think this new record is absolutely great. I super dig it. I mean, I like all the tracks. I super dig the track Vampire. So
Oh yeah.
Dave, you know, I reviewed the record and I said I like the song Vampire a lot. And I said I like any song that throws back the Jamaican concept of vampire and duppies. And in the comment section, people said, "No, that's not what it means." Dave, can you please vindicate me and say, at least in part, the song Vampires has some influence of the concept of vampires from Jamaican instrumentals, namely Lee Scratch Perry and King Tubby. Defend me, Dave. Defend me.
No, definitely. I mean, the initial like inspiration wasn't necessarily like Jamaican vampires, that sort of thing, but as the song kind of evolved in the songwriting, I mean, that became a part of it. I mean, I'm a big fan of, you know, like older Jamaican music, especially like stuff from the 70s. It's probably my favorite era. And that Lee Scratch Perry stuff is great. So you can kind of hear, like, even as the song evolved from the songwriting process, there's parts where, you know, I almost give it a little bit of like the pronunciation of vampire, like vampire, you know, kind of like slightly Jamaican patois influence a little bit. Just I don't want to get cheesy about it, but it was an accidental thing, but I thought it was really cool. It did kind of tie into that whole, you know, Jamaican folklore of duppies and vampires and all that stuff, you know. So I think it's kind of a cool tie-in.
With where did all my friends go? The title track, is that about like still being in the music scene while other people kind of washed away and faded away, or what's that track about for you?
You know, there's a lot of different meanings and to it. Initially, I mean, it was like just sitting at home in the pandemic, not being able to like interact with people. And it just felt like, you know, that sense of isolation that I think a lot of people felt. And that was sort of the impetus of the song where it started. But, you know, it's one of those things that, again, during the songwriting process, it kind of evolved. And it's like one of those things I think we realized that it kind of resonates in a lot of different ways. And it could be the music scene or just as people get older, I think you lose contact with a lot of friends and your life becomes a little bit less social, you know, at least that's been our experience. So, I mean, it's also that you kind of wonder, like, you know, you think back like in my 20s, I had a bazillion friends. And now I think I've far fewer, you know, and maybe the ones I have are probably more meaningful, whatever, but it's just one of those things, kind of looking back in retrospect, how that changes over time. So, I mean, with all our songs, I mean, any way people want to interpret them is cool with me. I mean, as long as they mean something to the listener, you know, that's what's important, you know. And I write stuff, and it's meaningful to me, and it can even change over time what it means to me. But yeah, I think all those interpretations are totally valid.
You sort of talked about this, I guess previously in this interview, in that like you guys don't put out an album if you're not. Well, you said the reason it took 10 years was because you're not always inspired to put out a new record. I thought this record sounded like a bunch of inspired people making music. I mean, were you charged up writing this record? Like this record doesn't feel like, and here's another record we've got. To me, this feels like we're ready to go. This is something that like we want to say and want to make and have real fire in our bellies about.
We definitely did. I mean, we have a lot of fire in the belly with this material. I mean, the last one, I think there was the last one we did, Can't Contain It, before that, we thought it was okay, but it's like we just didn't have the fire that we do on this one. And this one, we really felt really, really confident about material. And as a result, you know, we went back to the blasting room with Bill Stevenson, who's recorded, I think, our best records there. And we're like, you know, and, you know, it was a big commitment in both like time, but also, you know, a lot of money. I mean, we weren't, at the time, we weren't signed to any sort of record label. We didn't have any, like, the only ways to like put this, what to us is a big chunk of money together, was just like doing shows and sacrificing and that sort of thing. But we felt strong enough in the material to like, you know, put everything behind it, you know, and the time and the money and just a big chunk of our lives. So yeah, I mean, I think it's been a long time. Like me personally, I don't want to, in this case, speak for the other guys, but I mean, I haven't been this inspired by our material in a while, and I just felt really, really strong about it. I think the other guys did too.
What's it like working with Bill Stevenson? Because I mean, you know, he's a famous musician, he's a famous writer, he's a famous producer. I'm not sure which area he's, I guess, most well known, to tell you the truth. But you know, sometimes he comes off as kind of an interesting, kind of almost childlike guy. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? Like, what's it like working with Bill Stevenson?
It's really, he's a really unique guy. I mean, I don't know anyone else like him. This is like our fourth record recording with him, so it's nice we could kind of like jump in right from the start, and we already know him. You know what I mean? There's like no weirdness about getting to know this guy who can be kind of intimidating. I mean, he's a kind of a complex dude because on one hand he can seem very intimidating because not only is like he this like big dude, he's very, very self-assured as well. Like, and he'll just say like, I think this blah 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 blah. You know, he doesn't mince words at all. And you know, he has this like this legacy and this history, you know, going back from the Descendants and Black Flag, and then also like producing all these like really great albums as well. But we're lucky we kind of get past that sort of intimidation thing because we know him so well. But there is also like a certain element of like, I guess almost like, I don't know if I'm saying the right thing, but like almost like childlike innocence in terms of his curiosity. You know, he's like always trying to learn stuff. And one thing I learned really early on from him, but the first time we went to the studio with him, it's like he's not afraid to say he doesn't understand something or he doesn't know something and to ask a question about it. You know, there's a lot of people sort of like, you know, like don't want to express that they don't understand something. And it's like he doesn't have any fear of looking stupid. He doesn't have any fear of like, you know, not knowing something or whatever. He'll just say, I don't know what you're talking about. Explain it to me or whatever. Which is this huge lesson I've learned, not just through the studio, but in life, you know? And if someone like that can be like that open about it and saying like, I don't get it, I don't understand it, tell me what you mean. If that dude can be that kind of vulnerable, I think it's a huge lesson. It's something I definitely learned. And you know, you don't really grow or learn anything by like bluffing your way through something, pretending you know what you're doing. You know what I mean? And it's been really interesting because like the first time we recorded with him, he had never recorded horns. He had never recorded ska. He wasn't really even that familiar with ska. You know, he had heard the Specials and a few other things, you know, maybe the Untouchables or Fishbone back in the day a little bit. But we were like kind of like the first ska band he's ever worked with. And that's part of why he wanted to work with us, because like he's, you know, it's such a unique thing. But yeah, I mean it's really fascinating. He's a really fascinating dude, and it's been a, you know, you're working with him. I think the first time was like 1995, and that was before the Descendants reunited, and before he, you know, he's gone through all these like, you know, he's had brain surgery, which like he had an issue with his brain, like health problems that like affected his personality for a while. And it's been a really wild ride to see him like kind of like change the way he acts and works and thinks, but still remain the essence of Bill Stevenson, you know? And it was cool working with him again because he's so much of the stuff he's gone through with like his whole like health issues or whatever are in the past now. And he's just stoked for life. He's stoked to be doing what he's doing. And it's really great to like record with someone that's that stoked about things because we were as well, you know, excited about this material. So yeah, it was such a great experience.
Yeah, not to get off track, but if the listeners are interested about Bill's health issues, he's done interviews about that in depth, and it's
Yeah.
which is one of the crazy like is one of the craziest stories. He went to like an eye doctor because he was having trouble seeing, and his
Yeah.
eyes were like so pushed out of his skull. The eye doctor's like, "You need to go to like the brain surgeon immediately or something like that."
Yeah,
It's a
yeah.
crazy story. Anyways, getting back to Dave. Dave, you know, I'm gonna throw an idea past you, and I want you to disagree. You recently did another interview with Brooklyn Vegan, and you talked about how in like late 90s to early 2000s, it was cool to hate ska, and
Yeah.
it's nice now that with bands like Mustard Plug and Catbite and Kill Lincoln, that you know, ska is being welcomed again. I
Right.
would make the argument that the reason it became cool to hate ska was because although there were great bands like Mustard Plug, like No Doubt, like Sublime in the 90s, there were so many bad ones that flooded the market, and people
Right.
associated the bad ones with the good ones. So in effect, I almost feel like the bad bands killed the good bands, and I fear not so much now, but maybe last year, that that was starting to happen again. I don't know if that's your perspective on the rise and fall and rise of ska.
That was definitely a thing that hurt it back in the late 90s. That there were, I mean, ska got so big so fast that like every high school kid had a ska band. And a lot of those ska bands were just terrible. And we played with a lot of terrible ska bands back then. And part of the problem was like record stores would bring in anything that had ska in it. So all of a sudden they're like, what do you mean? This whatever crappy ska CD isn't selling. What's going on? And like promoters would book bands, ska bands that didn't really have a draw and weren't good bands either. So I think there were certain like gatekeeper people like that that just didn't do a good job of curating stuff. So there were a lot of like, there were a lot of crappy ska bands. And I think there were so many live shows and so many like these high school ska bands that probably should have spent some more time in their basement rehearsing or something. That definitely didn't help things for sure. But yeah, I don't know if I've seen that lately. I mean, if there's been a new surge of crappy ska bands, I hope not. I mean, maybe. we'll see. I mean, it's kind of like this latest, for lack of a better word, this later wave of ska popularity. It's only been happening for like, it seems like 3-4 years. And I don't think it's getting, my gut feeling is it's not going to get that much bigger than where it's at now, which is a kind of a good place to be, where it has a strong, like, kind of grassroots following, but it's not going to blow up like it did in the 90s, because that kind of just turned out to be bad news in the end. And I mean, that's what I'm hoping. It just kind of stays where it is right now. And the good bands will kind of rise to the top, and the not so good bands will just go to the wayside.
If you like ask Bad Manners about the term or idea ska, they won't say, oh, we're a ska band. They'll say, oh, well, we used to be a ska band, or we play some ska songs, but we're a band, not a ska band. Whereas mm-hmm. if you talk to Bad Manners, Buster Bloodrush, like, we're a ska band. We play yeah. ska. Where do you sit on that line or that spectrum?
You know, I see us as a ska band, not like a straight. I mean, we're not kidding ourselves to think that we're like pure ska or anything like that. I mean, Bad Manners are a lot more straightforward ska than we are. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things like people love the Bad Manners so much is that they've never hid from the term ska, which is like what all those other two-tone bands pretty much kind of said, oh, we're not doing that so much anymore, or whatever. Bad Manners always did that. And Mustard Plug, I think when we started the band, it was to start a punk-influenced ska band, right? And I think we stayed true to that. And we've never hidden from that. Over the ups and downs of ska over the last 33 years, we've never said that, like, no, we're a rock band with horns. Even when it was, you know, not cool to be a ska band, we're like, it is what it is. We're a punk-influenced ska band, and that's what we'll always be, you know? So, I mean, I would say there's some definite, I mean, parallels between us and the Bad Manners in terms of, like, sticking to our guns through good times and bad, right or wrong, you know?
Dave, a few last questions for you, then we'll play some tunes and we'll come back and do some news. Any genre, what are you listening to right now? Old stuff, new stuff? What are like 3 or 4 or 5 bands or artists you're listening to, current or old or whatever?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's crazy. So I just went to the record store 2 days ago and I bought like all old stuff. I bought like the Weaker Thans. I bought a Weaker Thans record. Shit, what did I buy? It's gonna kill me. I bought a Slackers record. I bought the first Slackers record. We're going on tour with them in a couple weeks. So I'm like, all right, I gotta make sure that like I'm familiar with everything. I listen to the Slackers. I'm a fan, but I'm not like I don't have every single record. I probably have like half their stuff. So I'm like, oh, let's pick up that one. I'm trying to think what else I bought. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, as far as I should like be shouting out some new bands. I know like we just got done with a little mini tour in the Midwest with Something to Do. They're from Wisconsin. They have a new record coming out in like 2 weeks. And those guys really blew me away. They're like completely under the radar, even under the radar of most of the 90% of the ska scene. I feel like they're only known in Wisconsin, but they're really good songwriters. And I'm really stoked for that record to come out. And there's a bunch of great, great ska bands coming out. Flying Raccoon Suit, like they just put out a new record. That's good. And Yeah, there's a bunch of good stuff out there.
As Dave mentioned, a Muscle Plug is going on tour. It kicks off December 13 in Ohio and hits mostly the East Coast. They'll be playing with the Slackers for about a week and a half or so. You want to talk about a killer lineup, Slackers and Mustard Plug. Looks like a little bit of Stop the Presses in there with Alley of Crazy in the Brains, the Freak Coasters. You want to talk about a killer lineup. That's a super killer lineup. Then in the early part of next year, starting in January 11, they'll be down in Georgia and Florida and Louisiana and Texas, and they'll be playing with Voodoo Glow Skulls and Bite Me Baby. So yet another killer lineup. Dave, lot of cool tour dates coming up for Mustard Plug. That's kind of
Definitely. And we have our annual holiday shows, like end of the year Christmas type shows in Chicago and Detroit and Grand Rapids as well. So yeah, we got lots of cool stuff lined up.
Two last questions for you. I know you guys are originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Did you used to live in the Michigan area, or are you somewhere else? Or
I've always lived in Grand Rapids.
Do you have any Stooges or Alice Cooper or Ted Nugent stories or anything like that? Or were they long gone? I mean, they were long gone by the time you guys got started. But
yeah, I mean, they're pretty long gone. I'm a huge Stooges fan. You know, I mean, it's cool. Iggy was from
In Ann Arbor, I think, right?
Oh, well, Ann Arbor is like kind of high school era, but like he was born in Muskegon, which is closer to us. Muskegon, Michigan, it's like this weird little town on Lake Michigan, like, I mean, really close, like half hour, 40 minutes away from us. Our drummer's from Muskegon, our old bass player, Rick, who used to be in the band, from Muskegon. Like back in the 80s, the late 80s, the one punk club that was open in the late 80s was called the Ice Pick, which was in Muskegon. So that's where Kyle and I used to go to see all the punk shows in the late 80s is to Muskegon. So, I mean, we have a real affinity to Muskegon. It's kind of rad that Iggy was from there. I mean, I saw something online somewhere on social media. It's like, let's erect an Iggy Pop statue in Muskegon, which would be amazing, you know? And every once in a while, like just living in Michigan, you'll hear like crazy stuff like, oh yeah, the Stooges played my prom or some crazy thing like that. So, I mean, we're definitely, I mean, I'm not really a huge Alice Cooper fan. Colin, our guitar player, is by totally, but I'm a huge Stooges fan, MC5 as well, you know? So I'm pretty proud to have those bands from my state.
Well, actually, I'm going to ask you about Alice Cooper anyways, even though you're not a real fan, because I am a huge fan.
Oh, cool.
I'm a massive fan, but I am annoyed that Alice is always like, we're from Detroit. No, he was born in Detroit, then moved to Phoenix, then LA, then the band was in Detroit for like 2 years, but he's like, we're from Detroit. I say Alice definitely is not from Detroit, despite the fact that he claims that. Does that annoy you that Alice says he's from Michigan when he's only from Michigan by the most threadbare definition?
Yeah, I don't think he can claim he's from Michigan.
Sorry. He does. Yeah. He did a whole album about how he's from Michigan. And I'm like, no, you're either from Phoenix or LA. You're not from Michigan. Anyways.
Honestly, it's just a lot cooler to say I'm from Detroit than to say I'm from Phoenix. Nothing against Phoenix, but it's just way cooler to say you're from Detroit. That's all there is to it.
Dave, last question on the new album. The new album is called Where Did All My Friends Go? It's out now via Bad Time Records. It's so good that it made me I was Mustard Plug neutral, and now I'm a big Mustard Plug fan. I dig the album a lot. I think it's perfectly paced. I think the songs are absolutely great. I love the track Vampire. Dave, what do you want people to take from the record or appreciate from the record, or what do you want the listener to experience, taste, or feel while listening to this new record by Mustard Plug out now via Bad Time Records called Where Did All My Friends Go?
Yeah, I just want people to hear it and just, you know, get whatever you get from it. You know, I mean, it's, I think everyone's going to have their own interpretation of it. You know, everyone's going to look at it differently, but hopefully if it has some sort of meaning to people, I'm totally happy about that, you know, whatever it means. But I, all I can say is like, we did put a lot into it. I think it sounds like a relatively fresh record considering we're a bunch of old dudes. And I think it holds up to like anything we've done or pretty much, you know, it's anything that's out there right now. I think it's in the running for a good album, you know?
Well, I definitely agree. Dave, should we play the title track? Should we play Vampire? Should we play Rebel Youth Face? What track should we play?
Throw on Vampire. Sure.
Here is Vampire, my favorite track from the album. Then we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
wonder why there's nothing left. You should have known it's meant to see what nothing but death.
We'll give Dave a quick rest while we talk to Em, who's been polite and letting me indulge myself in Alice Cooper conspiracy theories. Em, quite sadly, yeah. Shane McGowan of the Pogues died. And it was a little bit of a shocking because his wife did an interview with The Independent or something over in England or wherever that newspaper's called.
The Guardian.
And she said, The Guardian, I think it was. We hope to have him out by New Year's, which they showed a picture of him and he looked pretty bad. But I thought, we hope to have him out means, well, hopefully he'll be on his road to recovery and getting better. And they checked him out like last week. And I meant to do a news story and I didn't. And then he died. So apparently he was in like super bad shape. Em, what do the Pogues mean to you? And also, is the Shane McGowan story a story of victory or a story of failure and what could have been? I think back to Lemmy, you know, Lemmy's big thing was, I'm always going to party. I'm always going to drink. I love going on the road. I love having sex with strippers. I'm Lemmy. And we're like, yeah, Lemmy's the man. And then he died alone in his apartment due to liver failure, which was kind of not quite the blaze of glory you expected Lemmy to go out on. Or maybe it is, because he was like almost 70, I think, which isn't even that old. So, exactly. Moore, the story of Shane McGowan, how do you feel about that?
I have mixed feelings, I think is the way to put it. Because, like, it's an absolutely, like, incredible artist, like, incredible lyricist, but, you know, it's like, there's so many things that could have happened, and there's so many things that could have, like, he could have shone that much brighter, I guess is the way to put it, but it's like, I think he fell into, like, I'm an artist, so I have to be tortured, and I have to, you know, internalize a lot of stuff, and I have to, like, take everything in, and I have to, like, you know, self-medicate and everything, and that really, you know, that really sucks to see. But, I mean, his body work stands for itself. Like, he will always be remembered, regardless of the choices he made in life, for his art, and I think that's incredibly powerful and incredibly important. He meant so much, and the Pogues meant so much to so many people. So it really sucks to have him gone. Obviously, it's very sad that he's passed away, but I'm glad he was able to be surrounded by his family, and he was able to pass in a manner that was full of love instead of in a very clinical setting.
That's all true. I'll say it is kind of a shame. It's kind of a what could have been story, but it's a double-edged sword too, because the reason, without question, Shane McGowan first rose to, well, actually, the first main reason that Shane McGowan rose to prominence was because the Pogues, all of them, were an incredible, incredible band. Those first three records, even the first four, but those first three records are so insanely good, especially Rump Sodomy and The Lash and If I Should Fall from the Grace with God are as good as music gets. Those records are insanely good. And McGowan is so insanely good singing on those. It's like he's raw and ragged, but he's perfect, you know? So that's the first reason the Pogues became so huge. But the other is people love the personality that, like, oh, he's Shane McGowan. He's a mess. He drinks. He gets drunk and he sings. He's so soulful. Kind of like Tom Waits, even though actually Tom Waits has been sober since 1978, and no one knows that. And that, like part of the shit, like, he's a drunken Irishman that sings from his soul. Like, that's, like, the thing. And I think, well, is the booze and the cigarettes, is that really fueling the Shane McGowan art machine? Buzz Osborne of the Melvins has a great quote that I love. He says, you mean to tell me that if I take heroin, I'll play like Jimi Hendrix? Meaning mm-hmm. that the answer is it has nothing to do with the art, you know? Yeah. And so yeah. I think bottom line is, I mean, honestly, by the, like the Pogues kind of got not as good by the 90s. Although apparently, like, I thought they were terrible live, like, after them. But I've known lots of people that said, oh, I saw them, like, with McGowan, like, 2005, and they were incredible. So maybe they, like, I've got a Pogues live album from 2005. It's horrible. But Dave's going to speak about seeing that. But
oh, so I'm like a huge, massive Shane McGowan fan.
And, okay,
like,
yeah.
I saw him fairly recently, like, meaning, like, 10, 15 years ago, with the Pogues, when he got back together with the Pogues. And it was great. I mean, he's not jumping around stage, but his voice sounded really good. The band sounded amazing. They did all the hits. It was fantastic. And I'm like maybe I'm one of the few people, but I think his solo records, like Crock of Gold and what's the other one?
Isn't it Patty Rock and Roll or something like that? Or
no, no, it was a different solo record they put out.
The Snake.
Yeah, that one. It was really
great
good.
Great record.
The band is good, but it doesn't quite as click around you know, the songs as the Pogues do. I mean, it's not as good as, like, it's not as cohesive as like If I Should Fall from Grace with God, you know what I mean, something like that. But those are even great. It kind of shows that he had, it was a songwriting genius through the end, and it is sad. I think that his, you know, chemical dependencies, whether it was heroin at a certain point or, you know, gin towards the later part of his career, I don't think that has anything to do with his art. That it's just part of his personality, you know. But it is a tragedy that he died, but I'm also shocked that he's lasted that long. Because, I mean, quite frankly, I mean, 20 years ago, I never would have guessed he would have lasted another 20 years. But yeah, I don't know. I could go on because I'm a huge Shane McGowan fan. But it's profound when someone like that makes such a huge influence on so many people finally does die. You know, I mean, we know he's not going to be writing another Fairy Tale of New York at this point.
Well, I will say that Dave is an amazing artist, and Dave, you're a generally normal guy, aren't you?
Pretty much. I mean, if I was completely normal, I wouldn't be in a band. I'd probably be an accountant or something. But, you know, I do my best. So yeah.
Does great art require great torture or great pain?
I think it helps. I think if you're really well adjusted. I know personally, I think if you're a completely content, well-adjusted person, I don't think you'll have the drive to make great art personally. It doesn't mean that you have to become a heroin addict or whatever. you know, that's just a side thing. That's just, you know, ways certain people will deal with their demons, I guess. But I personally think if you're like, again, if you're like a completely well-adjusted person and not have like any sort of inner turmoil, I think you're just going to be like, you'd be an accountant somewhere and be happy and whatever. I think there's some sort of inner turmoil that forces people to create great art. But I mean, a lot of people say that's just a cliche, blah, blah, blah. I tend to believe the cliche, though.
Well, speaking of great art, Daryl Hall is suing John Oates to the shock of everyone in the world. Everyone always thought they were great friends, but actually, like as the listeners know, we interviewed Daryl Hall on the Punk News podcast, and Daryl Hall is famous for being a very angry interview. I love Daryl Hall interviews. He's always so pissed off. He's always like, the critics always hated us. Well, F them. And like, he keeps saying he doesn't care what the critics think, but the fact that they always got bad reviews but sold millions of records still bothers him. Although when we had him on the Punk News podcast, he was the man. And I credit that to myself for being an amazing interviewer, because I asked him about his long-lost solo record that he did with Robert Fripp, Sacred Songs, which is great. Anyways, the reason I bring all that up is Hall & Oates famously probably haven't gotten along for a long, 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 long time. But they kind of do the thing on stage and both in interviews where they don't talk smack on each other because that's bad for business. So they'll get on stage and they'll sit next to each other. But not if you notice, they don't sit that close to each other, kind of like some other bands that we that Em and I allude to all the time. Em, you know that certain band from the 90s that everyone loves, but that they stand far apart from the stage. Whereas Green Day, you know, they're kind of near each other on stage. They're hanging out. They're having good times. But another band of a similar size, they kind of stand far apart from each other. But, you know, because it's bad for business. Well, it's all come tumbling down because Daryl Hall has sued John Oates. And it's under seal, but certain details have leaked out. And those details are is that John Oates is selling either his publishing or his publishing and other assets related to the Hall & Oates business partnership, which is and Daryl Hall is saying, you can't do that without my permission. And certainly Daryl Hall and John Oates have an internal band agreement, unless John Oates works for Daryl Hall, which I thought was the case. Which I get, but I guess it's not. I guess maybe, I don't know if it's a 50-50 arrangement or 75-25. The point being is, I would have thought that in most internal band agreements, if one member wants to sell a share, if he's allowed to sell a share as opposed to abandoning it, usually the other band members have to be given the right to buy it first. Here, John Oates is selling his share either in the publishing or in the rights to the band itself to a third party, which for Daryl Hall is bad news, quite similar to when Mickey Lee sold his half of the Ramones rights and leaving Linda Ramone by herself. That is, it used to be a partnership. Even if you don't like the other person, it's a partnership. You know who the other person is. You've got some sort of relationship. Now, Daryl Hall is facing the threat of having a new business partner that he never agreed to be business partners with. And frankly, I think Daryl Hall is going to win this because I mean, we don't have any of the real details, but I think it seems shady to me. I mean, I can't imagine that as huge as Daryl Hall is, having sold millions and millions and millions of records, they wouldn't have an internal band agreement that allows one part of the other party the option to buy all the rights first if one guy wants to sell. And so Daryl Hall, though, that being said, just like Linda Ramone, is in a scary situation where, oh, I used to be in a partnership with another artist who's a guy, and of course we want to make money. But he's an artist, and now I'm in partnership, or I'm facing being in partnership with a holding company, which, as we all know, holding companies act very, very different than artists. Such as Spotify, I mean, not Spotify, Bandcamp, great example. Same with the Ramones and Mickey Lee selling to some holding company. Dave, is that scary to you? I mean, you ever think about that, or what's your opinion on Daryl Hall's stance? You know?
Yeah, I mean, if that's the case, I can totally feel like his pain. That sucks. I can't imagine like him not being offered that share. That would be terrible. Cause you don't start a band to go be partners with a holding company, like you said, you know?
Yeah.
My Mustard Plug is not like a real big commercial enterprise like Daryl Hall, John Oates for sure. So no one's knocking on our door to buy Mustard Plug, fortunately. So we didn't have to deal with that. But yeah, that's tough, man. It's tough that like they should just be like enjoying life and all their huge shows with their money and their fame and love, and they have to get down into lawsuits. I kind of feel for them. That sucks.
That's a great comment. And they've made it 10 times over. All they have to do now is get up on stage, have fun, and rake in the cash, and they can't do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, tragedy.
actually, Dave, I'm going to quote Mike Park mentioned this. Is Mike Park of Asian Man Records, of course, and Skank. Mike Park says that because he's been in so many bands, he's able, and I'm not going to ask you to name names, he's able to watch a band and determine which bands still are friends and which bands hate each other. Dave, do you have that ability?
That's funny. What's that? Sorry.
You have that ability. Can you watch a band and realize if they hate each other or not?
I don't have quite that sixth sense that he has. And I don't know. I think that there's way fewer ska bands that hate each other, because it's just not that lucrative to be a ska band, quite frankly. So if you don't love it, then I don't know why you'd stay in a band with somebody. But I think if you get to a certain level, like Hall & Oates, I mean, if you hate the guy, you're going to bite your tongue and go on stage and rake in $1 million. You know what I mean?
Dave, not to beat this horse to death, and I'm gonna ask him about it real quick. But Dave, can you imagine like being like, what was it be like to be like, or the Ramones, another great example. Black Flag's another great example. Everyone hates each other in the band. They absolutely hate each other, but they had to go on stage and like duet, you know, like Rich Girl's a duet, you know what I mean? Or like no can go for that. Like they're both singing all the time. What, like, do you think you can set aside your hatred while you're on stage and say we got a job to do, or what do you think that's like?
I don't think I could do it. Like, there's just no way. I mean, we could do it. You know, I mean, being in a band with like six or seven dudes, you're probably going to hate somebody at one point or another all the time. You know what I mean? It's just a different guy. You don't always get along with everybody. But I mean, to do that. So, I mean, a show or two, here or there, you know, I can totally understand hating a fellow band member. I'm sure that just happens. But to do it on a sort of a permanent basis, like long term, oh, that sounds just so miserable. There's no way I could do it, you know.
And actually, if I'm sorry, I said I wasn't going to be saying, but Em and I talked about this before. Of course, Joey and Johnny hated each other so much, and you would say, you know, after 10 years, wouldn't you both just say, fine, we hate each other, but I don't know if we need to burning hate each other. Like, let's just work together and like, you know, you stole my girlfriend, or maybe you didn't because I dumped her. It's like, oh well, that was, we were 25, you know, we're 40 now. Like, let's just get on with it, man. Like, don't you think that eventually you would be able to do that? Like, how come the Ramones hated each other till the bitter end, when it would be so easy just to say, you know, let's just not be friends, but be associates. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's mind blowing to me. Yeah. Well,
anyway, M, I've thrown so much at Dave. M, what's your stance on the Hall versus Oates battle? Who's going to win? Who are you backing in this fight to the death?
Ooh, I think Hall's going to win. I have that vibe. I was surprised when I read it initially because I was like, oh my gosh, again, it's one of those things. You know, you always see Hall and Oates. Like, you just kind of assume like they at least sort of get along. You know, and then you read the, like Hall said, Oates had been aggressive and adversarial over the past few years, and they're basically in the middle of like a public divorce and like stuff like that. And then, you know, Oates fires back with, this is inflammatory and outlandish and inaccurate, and I'm deeply hurt, but I want to sell my shares. And it's like, ooh, it's just messy. It's also one of those things where, like, you think that if they had a disagreement, they would have so many channels to, like, go through before it was like, you know, we're taking this to the courts. We're taking this to, you know, we can try to work it out a little bit, but nope. So I think Hall has more of a, like, a leg to stand on in this battle, but we'll see how it plays out. I don't think we're done, and I think there's going to be a lot more come out. So...
Speaking of factions, Crass, another famously splintered band, which was splintered into two factions, which proves, and I'll say, in a band, a democracy and a communism does not work. It should be a dictatorship, maybe a dictatorship light, but a dictatorship in some form. Dave, can a band be a democracy, or does it need to be a dictatorship or dictatorship light?
I think it's really hard. I mean, Mustard Plug is pretty democratic overall. I think the people who've been in the band the longest have more of a say than people who've not been in a band for, you know, a couple years, that sort of thing. But I think it's important with our band to, like, at least we try to be democratic. We try to, like, get everyone's input on major decisions, stuff like that. But it's really hard. It'd be way easier if it was just a dictatorship, for sure. I'm a little jealous of, like, bands that just have like one guy can just make the decision and that happens. That sounds so much easier.
Well, you know, I always love to point to Glenn Danzig. Like, whatever Glenn says, that's what's going. If you don't like it, you're out of the band, you know?
Yeah.
But then again, Chumbawamba, total communist, not even dictatorship, communist thinking, one of the greatest bands ever. Anyways, the reason we're talking about Crass is there's, of course, two Crass factions. There's Penny, Steve, G, and Eve on one side and the other members on the other side. And Crass is putting out a book called Crass, A Pictorial History. And really just kind of like newspaper clippings and flyers and that kind of a stuff. And I would say for Crass, that's actually kind of more fitting than most bands. I mean, some books put out like picture books and, you know, you flip through it once, you're like, wow, here's a picture of Debbie Harry. Wow, here's a picture of Iggy and David Bowie. And you look at it once. Of course, Crass famously during their 7-year run were in the newspapers all the time. They did that famous KGB hoax. They did that famous jamming thing. And so Crass was in the newspaper from the beginning to the end, which was kind of cool. Plus, they played a lot of rad shows and there's some cool flyers there. So they're putting out a book called Crass, A Pictorial History. It follows the excellently done Crass reissue series, which I think is probably the best reissues ever done ever, in terms of maintaining respect for the fundamental work while increasing it and giving extra stuff that's worthwhile. People are kind of bitching about the price, £50, which is about $70 USA. I don't know what it is in Canadian money.
$85.63.
Oh, I thought you guys did it flapjacks or something. So, it's a little pricey, but on the other hand, what's cool is it's printed in England, while a lot of other people are getting their books printed in China, and Crass is getting their book printed in England, you know, under fair working conditions, which is pretty cool. And also, the one thing about, you know, so many crust-punk and anarcho bands is that they print their records cheaply. They put out cheap books. While Crass actually did the exact opposite the whole time, is they actually made their stuff look really nice and be in really nice editions. So it's £50 a lot. Yeah, it is. But on the other hand, I mean, it's Crass. The book, I'm sure it's really well done. I know for a fact that Penny and G Voucher, like, go over like every inch of these things. They don't like farm them out. Like when you're reading this is Penny Rimbaud and G and asking other people for input on, I guess, the visual history of Crass. So it looks cool. And do you think this looks cool, or is this a form of selling out by the least sellout band of all time?
This isn't selling out at all. Like, it's their own like pressing publishing company. Like, it, they're doing everything themselves, and it's over 300 pages. It's probably going to be like a decent size, like coffee table kind of book, you know, like it's going to be big. It's like you said, printed in England, like it's going to be of really high quality. They could charge upwards of like $100 for this. It's like, it's a little steep, but again, for what you're getting, it makes sense. They said like it's been in the works for 30 years, almost, or around 30 years, over 30 years. So like they've put a lot of time and a lot of effort into it. I think it's going to be more than just here's a newspaper clipping. I think it's going to be like, here's some, you know, stuff, and then we're going to write something about it. Or there's going to be like some art piece with it. Like there's going to be something else. Like you're not just going to see a bunch of like, you know, things you've seen 50 times regurgitated back, you know, just for a quick buck or whatever. That's not who they are, and that's not who they've ever been. So if they started now, that would throw how many years down the drain, you know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense. So those are my thoughts on it. I think the book looks cool.
Em, are you mad at Crass for not accepting my remix as the winner of the Crass remix entry contest?
Livid.
Dave, yes. Are you a Crass fan? And if not, what band would you like to see have a pictorial history?
I'm not a huge Crass fan. I mean, it's just one of those bands I just never really got into. I don't think they suck or anything like that. I just never, for whatever reason, just not got into them. I think it's rad what they're doing. I think it's cool. If I had to pick like one band that would do it, I guess I'd probably suck. I can't do it. It'd either have to be the Specials or Fugazi. I think either one could be really cool. I can't pick one.
Dave, the passing of Terry Hall, was that a shock to you? Was that saddening?
Yeah, that one hurt. I don't know. I mean, there's a few like way more than Shane McGowan, because again, I thought Shane McGowan, even though I'm a huge, huge fan, I thought he was going to die. It's been really obvious he could die any minute for the last 20 minutes. But Terry Hall was kind of secretive about his condition. And, you know, and he was still producing stuff, and the Specials were still like releasing new material. They were touring, they were active. I actually got to meet Terry probably like 7 years ago, and he was a total sweetheart, you know? And so I felt kind of blindsided, and he's definitely been like someone who's had a huge influence on me, you know, more than most, for sure, as far as singers go. I mean, the Specials would probably had more influence on me than any other band, period. So yeah, that one kind of stung, and I'm usually pretty have thick skins about celebrity deaths or whatever, but that was probably one of the hardest ones I've felt.
So how did the Dave Terry Hall meeting go, if you don't mind divulging? Were you guys like, hey, what's going on? Did you guys, you know, give a heart to heart to each other? What was that meeting like?
Well, so that was just, it was real brief, but I used to manage this band called Deals Gone Bad from Chicago. And they're sort of like a trad soul ska band, right? And they got to open up for the Specials. And so I was there just kind of hanging out backstage. And after the show, everyone cleared out. And Terry was just hanging out there. I don't know. And I just went up to him, and you know, I'm kind of like shy, but I'm like, when it comes to like meeting your idols, it's a scary thing because it can be turned out real bad too sometimes. But you know, I just got the courage. I'm like, hey Terry, I just want to let you know, like I'm in a ska band for like 20 years and I'm a big fan. I just, you know, your music has meant a lot to me and I really dug it. And I even said, you know, I think your solo stuff's great. I mean, at that point, the Specials hadn't like reunited. And, you know, I mentioned like he had done a solo record with this guy who was like Terry Hall, I think Mushtek or whatever, that I thought was kind of cool. It was a really kind of obscure little thing. So I think he was impressed that I actually had heard that. And so, you know, I talked to him for maybe it was like 3 minutes, 4 minutes, something like that. But he was just really kind and gracious, you know. And so and it's you know, that 3-4 minutes meant a lot to me.
In fact, didn't Mustard Plug form at a Special Beach show, which was the English Beat and Specials touring together in like their like early 90s as like one big combo band or something like that?
Yeah. We didn't really form, but that's where Colin and I first kind of like, I saw him at the show and we had kind of been friends of friends, didn't really know each other real well, but we were like kind of like the only, it felt like we were the only ska fans from Grand Rapids at the time. And this was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I was just like, Colin, we should start a ska band in Grand Rapids. That's the first one. And that's kind of where, that's the spark of where it started. Yeah, for sure.
Feel free to take a pass. This. What do you think Jerry Dammer's deal is? Jerry Dammer's, of course, is the originator of the Specials. Yeah. Total weirdo. And the only thing he does now is he does like a Sun Ra tribute band that he's been doing for like 30 years.
Yeah.
So what's your take? Like super genius that had to move away from ska because he's a super genius and he couldn't do that the whole time? Or total weirdo that maybe should have had more focus?
I think he's a total weirdo, first of all. I think that's the most obvious answer. It's just like, you can't understand it because he's a weirdo. But that's one of the big mysteries because he was like such an incredible songwriter. I mean, he's so influential. I mean, we wouldn't be playing ska, I think, if the Specials didn't exist. But I also wonder, like, if he had such a successful, like, you know, like 3-year run, I wonder if at a certain point he just got like fear of ever trying to live up to that. You know what I mean? Because I mean, some of those songs like Ghost Town, Free Nelson Mandela, the first Specials record were so impactful on music, period, you know, that like, I wonder if he got to the point where like, I'll never be able to reach those highs again. It's just fear of failure type of thing. I have no idea. I've thought about it a lot. And that's one of the things that I've pulled out of my ass, whether it's true or not. But I think the weirdo theory is probably the most plausible one.
And actually, Dave, feel free to throw this back at me, but you bring up a really big point is with guys like Jerry Dammers or guys like Elvis or guys like Jack Terrycloth of World Inferno Friendship Society or even like Prince, is I wish they'd taken a note from Frank Sinatra in that sometimes you're up here and then sometimes you're down here, but you can get back up here or you might get, you know, it's not up and then down. It's a wave that can go up and down, up and down. And I wish some of those artists could have seen that and kind of realized that. Look at David Bowie. Even David Bowie wasn't always up. He had that terrible mid-80s period, and then he came back in the late 90s. He was awesome again, you know? So I wish some of these guys that had that pressure, and I should say women too, Amy Winehouse, I wish that they Ari Up of the Slits, although she died of cancer, which is kind of different. I wish they could have maybe understood that, well, it's not a one-way street. It's a two-way street that moves up and down all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yep.
I basically just asked Dave to say, I said, Dave, say yes to me. Anyway, Emor, One last story. Honestly, we talk about Danzig way too much on the podcast, but that's because I'm a huge fan. And he's this fabulous weirdo that I think it's perfect that he's weirdo. I think that's the main point, is that he's a weirdo. They're finally releasing Death Rider on DVD and Blu-ray. And of course, they announced it, they posted it, and then they deleted it all from the internet for like a week and a half, and they posted the exact same thing back up. So who knows what was going on. And more, I think I forget if you're a fan of Danzig, but you're not really a fan of the movies or Danzig movies, correct?
I like Danzig. I haven't experienced the cinematic masterpieces that are his movies.
Well, I've seen them both, and they're not cinematic. I mean, I'm a huge fan, but they're not cinematic masterpieces. And I've said before, is the tragedy, if you will, of both Danzig movies is, at their core, they're kind of a cool idea. The first one was, let's do Tales from the Crypt. The second one was, let's do a cowboy movie where everyone's a vampire and they shoot each other all the time. That sounds pretty cool. But I wish Danzig had not yes men around him, but no men saying, that's a cool idea, Danzig, but you don't have the skill. You're the man when it comes to music, but movies, that's not something you can wing. Like you can kind of wing music. Movies, you have to know how to hold a camera. You have to know how to light a scene. You have to know where to hold the boom mic. So I wish for Danzig that he had someone to say, tell me what you want this to be, and then we'll do it, you know? So M, the story of the two Danzig movies. They're bad. They're real bad. The second one isn't as bad as the first. Is it cool that Danzig tried something different and it was a swing and a miss? And that's all right, because sometimes art is a swing and a miss. Or is it a misstep because he didn't take his art seriously enough and was too full of himself to get help when he needed help? What's your take?
I think swing and a miss is how it is, because like you have to try new things. You have to, you know, try it to see if you're good at it. You have to try to see if you like it. You have to see if, like, it pans out. You know, you have to try everything. And if it doesn't hit, it doesn't hit. That's fine. But you know that there's going to be one kid or one person somewhere who that's going to be their moment. They're going to see that and they're going to be like, I can do this, or I can do this better, or I can take this idea.
I think a lot of people said that. I think I said that.
Where's your when's your vampire western coming out?
Once I secure financing, then we'll get on our way. I'll hire Dave to do the soundtrack. We'll do a vampire spaghetti ska soundtrack.
Hell yeah!
And it'll be rad. we're gonna tie everything up at the very end. Although people love to make fun of, I never make fun of Danzig. People love to make fun of Danzig. I went to the last screening of Veronica, which is the first one. Mm-hmm. And by that time, people were already like tearing it up online. And the entire movie, people were like laughing at it, not with it, like at it, like, oh, this is terrible. And even though the whole time people were laughing at it, except me, because I'm a fan, and I was like, at least Glenn tried. People were laughing at it. Is at the end, he came out and signed everybody's autograph that wanted an autograph. He didn't throw a hissy fit. He came out and, you know, so I got to say, people say Danzig's a diva, but a lot of people, I think, would have just went home and he came out and he signed autographs and hung out with people, which was kind of cool. Dave, I don't know if you saw any of the Danzig movies or if you're a Danzig fan. So what's your perspective on Danzig, the man, Danzig, the film, or if you don't want to? What's your take on art that's a swing and a miss? Should they have tried harder, or is that just the nature of the game?
You know, I think it's both. I think maybe on the first movie, you can put it like the swing and the miss. But maybe for the second one, he should have probably said, oh, this didn't, I missed on that one. Maybe I should get someone to look over this script, and maybe I should get a better, camera person or lighter. I haven't seen the movies. I can kind of imagine.
Dave, but you have kids, right, Dave?
I think you have to learn from your mistakes. Otherwise, you know, that's kind of the definition of madness, right?
Dave, you have kids, right,
Dave? Inspirational, though. That story about, like, people, I didn't realize that when you saw him, that Danzig was there and people are laughing at this movie. That would destroy the average person. And the fact that he had, like, kind of like the grace to come out and still, like, sign an autograph for his fans after being, like, kind of insulted to his face, that gives me, like, a lot more respect for him than I would have guessed. You know what I mean? I don't know that much about him. He seems like he has an enormous ego, and with enormous egos are usually pretty fragile. But the fact that he could do that, that's pretty badass to come out and sign autographs after people have been laughing at your movie, you know? So good for Danzig.
Well, there's our closing words. The new Mustard Plug album is out now. It's great. You can get it on Bandcamp. It's called Where Did All My Friends Go? You can get it at badtimerecords.com. You can get it from Mustard Plug on tour in mid-December and early January. And they're touring with the Slackers before the end of the year. And they're touring with Voodoo Glow Squad at the end, beginning of next year. So it's going to be real cool. Is it theslackers.com? Is that your website, Dave? I mean, is it mustardplug.com? Is that your website?
Mustardplug.com. Yep. You can, that'll take you wherever you need to go.
So we're going to wrap this up and we're going to tie everything together with a band that did do a Wild West song. Actually, we're going to play, we'll play two songs. We'll play another Mustard Plug song. Dave, what other Mustard Plug song should we play?
How about Fall Apart?
This is Fall. We'll play Fall Apart, and then we will wrap everything up with the band that did a Wild West song. No, they're not a Wild West band. We're doing the Pogues, the only time they did a ska song. And more, do you know what the ska Pogue song is?
I do not know what the ska Pogue song, Pogue song is. What is it?
From the Straight to Hell movie or whatever?
Actually, there might be two, actually. You might be right. The one I'm thinking of is London Girl off Pogetry in Motion.
Yeah, right.
Dave, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Everyone, be sure to check out the new Mustard Plug album and see Dave on tour. It'll be cool. And Dave, thanks again.
Thank you.
through the alley, down by the corridor and the centrale, to the muse running through the back streets, where the blacks sell fire and sleep. The devil moon took me out of Soho, up to Camden where the cold north winds blow, sucked along by a winter shower, stand beside your shining tower. This could be our final dance. This could be our very last chance. Sound of your voice wherever I may be changes everything, and then the world's all right with you.
My lovely girl,
the way that you walk.
My lovely girl,
the way that you talk.
My lovely girl,
just the sound of your voice. I ain't got no chance. The lights were going out, the moon was dying, the night was turning to the fine spring morning, the dogs were barking and the kids were shouting, the sun was flashing in a crystal fountain. When the cold winds come and find you blowing down from the top of the high rise, I'll come and take you back down to Soho, away from all those madmen's eyes. This could be our final dance. This could be very last chance. And if you cut me, don't you think I feel? It's this body play, it's this heart made of steel.
You're my lovely girl,
the way that you walk.
You're my lovely girl,
the way that you talk.
You're my lovely girl,
just the sound of your voice. I ain't got no choice. London.